Ready to dive in? Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast. Every episode, we explore, expand, and evolve our understanding of the truths we encounter and experience in our human quest for clarity and exponential growth. And now welcome your hosts, Dr. Jeffrey Smith and Jim Case. Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast.
Good afternoon, evening, or morning to everyone who's watching. Dr. Jeff here with my esteemed colleague, Jim Case, in Adventures in Truth Podcast for episode, what's that, Jim?
35, I think.
Number 35. Wow. Awesome. Yeah. 35 times of having fun.
Yeah.
hope that some of you folks that are watching or listening, we used to do this audio only, and we've recently forged ahead and tried to add video to this thing, and that's always if you haven't tried this, it's different every week.
Yeah.
There's some new nuance or gremlin or something that manages to test our patience and grow us. Anyway, welcome everyone, and we're looking forward to you hanging out with us for the next hour and a half, 2 hours, and seeing where we go with all of this as we're exploring what we think are truths, what we think and want to share with others, make more sense, answer questions, or just, you know, we're just pushing in to explore things we've learned, things we've been taught that may not resonate with us any longer, or we might want to just look a little deeper or go a little farther. Mm-hmm. So today I wanted to reach back all the way back to my dear and lovely friend, I never met, but I know him through reading and studying only, Dr. Sigmund Freud.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's quite a reach back, huh?
Wow.
So his work was referenced in some of the material that I'm studying right now regarding the Law of One. And he was talking about this term called repetition compulsion. And I remember going through and learning about this in my doctoral program, but, you know, that was, as we all study things and time goes by, you kind of forget what you learned and then you relearn it and go, oh, yeah, I kind of remember a little bit about that. That was really cool. How did I forget that? So where we've come since Dr. Freud's work and coining that term as a defense mechanism, where we've gone since then is people taking his work and doing some research and experimentation with it. And primarily where this kind of comes close to home for me is in my work with veterans who have post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And helping them understand why they do what they do. And of course, you know, it's why I do what I do and why you do what you do and why we all do what we do. So some of that has to do with this thing called repetition compulsion. So really what that is why do we repeat these behaviors? Particularly the ones that seem to, on the outside, not serve us,
mm-hmm.
Habits, compulsions, addictions, any of these sorts of things, these repetitive behaviors that we seem compelled to do over and over and over and over again, that actually, when you study them, look at them, examine them, open yourself up to other people getting into your life and helping you take a peek at all this, seem to be quite misbehaviors or misgivings or quite dysfunctional, yet we still do it. So where I was wanting to go today is just talking a little bit about why. And once we can get into the why, then offering ways to do the why not or create an alternative path away from these things.
Cool.
Yeah.
I have some immediate thoughts if you're interested.
Yeah, let's hear the thoughts.
Like it triggered a flood. So,
oh wow, like a Noah's Ark flood.
Yeah, just like a Noah's Ark flood. So, the thought that I was having about that, just as a broad stroke, about why we do those things, is that if we isolate an incident, like, you know, the guys that come back that are my very dear friend in South Carolina who is dealing with cancer was just calling, and we don't get to talk very often. And it's odd that she would call me, so I'll have to call her back. But anyway, I'm sorry. Focus. Here we go. So the incident, the occurrence that is apparently the source of the post-traumatic stress, in my mind, is not, we limit the scope maybe too much of what we look at and isolate incidences rather than look at the progression of an individual through their life experience. And the reason the habits are there is because the brain has that locked in. It's been myelinated. It's a track in the brain. And every time a stimulant occurs that hits that particular tread, you're going to have an experience based on that. But I think that the repetitiveness comes because the source of, for instance, the post-traumatic stress may have come as a result of being in a war zone. Okay, so there was an impact moment. There was an intensity that occurred. But the underlying motivation of it isn't from there, because what led them in their life to be in that moment in that time was still about their life and their evolution and their progress. So the events that are occurring as a result of all of that has come before, not the week that came before. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So there are habits that were built in, and all that the PTSD does is exacerbate those thoughts. It connects them in a weird way, at least the way I understand it and the way I've seen it, is it connects things in a way that makes it appear that it's not a habit. But the reality is what they're exhibiting is from a habit. They were already in that zone somehow, in some form, and it may not have been as a post-traumatic stress, but it was in their thoughts and in their life experience. There was a consistency, and there is a consistency to their thoughts and their beliefs and their behaviors that led to that point. I almost think that those events sometimes, or in many cases, it seems like those events, like those intense events, are specific to bring forth that clarity, that it's not just about the event. It's about everything that came before the event that brought you to the event that brings you to the other side of the event. So I hope that A, B, C, D thing sort of went there. But that's the immediate like chunk of stuff that fell in my head as soon as you were talking, was it's not a limited box. Those events are not isolated. They're actually an integral part of their life experience.
Sure.
And when you take it out of that experience, it changes how you look at it.
Okay. So where I was going in this thought thread is not the exposure to whatever someone would consider traumatic, not the actual event itself.
Right.
The compulsion to repeat a behavior that we know is not good for us is really what I'm talking about. Bad habits.
Same thing.
Smoking, no matter what you're smoking, if it's not, you know, no matter what you're smoking, it's not a healthy behavior. If you're inhaling a smoke is not good for the lung. It, in regard to maybe THC or CBD, there are other ways to get it in your system, which could be medicinal, but generally smoke itself is not healthy. And I'm not taking a hardline stance on that. And I'm not trying to offend anybody, but I'm just really more like nicotine products. There really isn't any positive benefit from consuming those. So that would be a behavior, or excessive, anything to excess. Let's just go with that. Anything to excess.
Well, anything to habit. You don't even have to go to excess. You just have to go to habit. Repeated behavior.
So that's really what would fall into the repetition compulsion, including interactions in relationships where couples fight, whether that's emotional sabotage or barrage or just being mean or rude or, you know, actually getting to a physical altercation, happens quite frequently. Look, video games, pornography, all of these things that, without putting a judgment on them, again, whether it's habitual, like you said, Jim, or it's compulsive, or it like takes on a life of its own, it has an energy that is, seems to be driving me rather than me choosing it. It's coming for me. That's the line that I wanted to address. And, you know, if people are interested in taking a look, we all have some of those things going on in our life. Yeah. And this would be an opportunity to dig in and explore it a little bit more deeply. So that I found myself recently getting reminded of some of the research that was done on combat vets, where the researchers got into their lives and had some idea of the specific traumas that they experienced, where it was maybe an IED explosion, or they witnessed something that they saw the loss of life, or they were scared for their own life. And it was registered in the brain in a way that it stays in short-term memory and it gets re-triggered when stimulated by current day activity that looks like, smells like, feels like, resonates with, all those sorts of things. And the mind connects the dots. And there's a re-experiencing, a partial re-experiencing of a discontent mindset. What's interesting, what's absolutely fascinating to me, is that when they were wired up for heart rate variability, perspiration, respiration, any of the ways that you can measure a person's getting triggered, stimulating, or being aroused, and I'm not talking about aroused in a sexual or a enjoyable way, I'm talking about a negative arousal where the autonomic nervous system is activated. What was really fascinating is they wired all these guys up and they exposed them to combat video, expecting, this is the big, you know, here's the drum roll, little drum roll here, expecting to see arousal states go up, and they didn't. They went down. And the researchers went, wait a minute, that completely blows our hypothesis, but, you know, let's try not to get attached to our expected outcome, and let's just see where the research takes us and see what we can learn from this. So they wanted to understand why, when watching combat videos to things that you meet the criteria for PTSD, why did the body sedate itself rather than activate itself? And so then they had to do blood draws and they had to do other labs to understand chemically and what was going on in the body. What they found was a massive secretion of analgesics on the pituitary gland. So let's get into that word for a moment. When you go to have surgery, you have anesthesia. So the difference between an anesthesia and an analgesic is anesthesia kills the pain. It blocks the pain from the mind so that you don't experience the surgeon cutting on you. Mm-hmm. An analgesic deadens the pain or decreases the pain, but it is not as strong and as an anesthetic. So once again, the mind, this amazing thing that we wear above our shoulders, this noggin that we have, has the ability to create opium-like, sedative-like properties that create a relaxing condition. So here, let's go through this one more time and a little more slowly. So, combat vet, diagnosed with PTSD, wired for sound and everything else, sits down, watches combat video, and rather than being triggered and freaking out, ducking for cover, their body goes into a state of relaxation, or more of a state of relaxation. So they find themselves wanting to watch violent video, wanting to engage in violent video games, wanting to engage in violent activities and behaviors that may not be healthy for them, but it's their version of taking a chill pill. So the same way with couples, when they get into nasty fights, it's their compulsion repetition that gets them to fight once every 3 days, once every week, whatever their cycle is of getting their fix. And this is where the awareness and the truth can take place. It's like, because most couples will say outwardly, we don't like to do this. I want to end the relationship, or I want to break up with you because I don't like all the freaking drama. Mm-hmm. That's what they say consciously. But their behavior says, well, you're still in it. You still show up and do the dance. So what's the deal? So I'm sharing what the deal is we're getting a fix from it. And to be honest and open and say, wow, huh, I wonder if there might be a different way I could get my calming fix rather than have to do battle with my sweetie and step on his or her toes, mm-hmm. and say things that I regret later and wish I didn't do or whatever. But once we realize what we're doing and why we're doing it, then we have the opportunity to choose a different path. Any thoughts about all that, Mr. Jim?
Not really any different than what I've expressed so far. I'm curious about the interpretation of that release of the stuff you were talking about. That intrigues me because it sort of flies in the face of, not really, but I was going to say it sort of flies in the face of what the idea is about, and you know, someone being triggered by whatever, you know, whether it's a vet or anybody else, that that the triggers are engaging, but somehow. So is it that the body is? The question that it leaves me with is it that the body is protecting something, or is it that the body is acknowledging it's a non-event? The point being is that it's a non-event. So there's nothing in the physical body, maybe, and I'm kind of scrapping through this. So I guess what I'm questioning or trying to understand more is, do we have a clear indication of why the body has that response? Because immediately I went to, oh, that's interesting. And it's interesting because it's showing that the event that we think is the event is not the event. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't cause, I mean, they may be moving to using, like you were saying, violent video games or stuff like that to stimulate that feeling. But I think the addiction comes because they're not getting that feeling.
Like anything else, there's a tolerance. And you have to do more of the same to reach the same effect over time. So the fights get worse. The drama gets louder. The fight increases. So, you know, I like where you're going with this, because underneath, let's just take a couple that's in a relationship and they find themselves having a weekly breakup, a weekly dialogue, a fight or something that's happening fairly regularly.
Yes.
So over time, the fights get worse and the sensitivity gets less. The sensitivity to the trigger gets less. So it takes less to start the fight. But because there's a threshold that has to get reached for the analgesic to actually begin the sedation, there has to be more intensity in it so that that amount of hormone, neurotransmitter, and enzyme, particularly the opiate-based hormones and enzymes, get released so that there is that sedating effect.
Right, but I still think we're kind of going cart before the horse. In that there's still the what each individual brings to the process. So the attraction is the stimulation, meaning at least to my way of thinking and how I see is like the two individuals in the relationship are part of the we talked about this in a previous podcast. Part of the alignment that they have created with each other is that point of attraction. That point of attraction, and when I say point of attraction, it's neither positive nor negative, but it can be either positive or negative, right? So the point of attraction is each individual has their version of whatever is underlying what creates that desire to fight. And it didn't start with this relationship. It had to start in other relationships.
Of course.
Because the core of who we learn our relationships from are our parents. That's where we learn how to have a relationship. And whatever we see there is what we assume is normal. So the conflict can be in so many, I mean, it's so insane to me, the number of permutations there, because say one partner's version is completely different from the other partner's version because they came from completely different places,
right?
And completely different experiences but there is an alignment that occurred that brought those two energies together so that those energies could be brought to light. I think ultimately it's about when it gets to the point where you can consciously see it operating, now it's a matter of what we've talked about all along. There has to be a place where state shift occurs. There has to be a place where each individual has to understand their own process and then how that process is interacting with each other. But it's just a triggering mechanism, right? I mean, that's what I would think it is. There's, you know, if it's two guys or two girls or a guy and a girl, whatever, it's you say or do things that trigger me about things that you have no idea about. And I say and do things that trigger you that you have no idea about. And they have nothing to do with the individuals together in relationship, meaning the resolution for that is not in the relationship. It's in the relationship with self. It's not in the relationship with each other.
Of course.
So the habit of it, I think, is that the focus tends to be on why is the relationship not working instead of why am I not working in the relationship?
Yeah, I agree.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you start to dive into that, you might find a little more information, maybe. But again, the habits are the problem. The habits are, he brings this and she brings this, or he brings this and he brings this. And all that luggage doesn't, I mean, how many people do you know that have gone into relationships that clearly know all of each other's baggage? Can clearly identify all of the baggage they're bringing in. There's like none,
right?
maybe. And part of that problem is because we don't know what bag we're bringing.
Sure. Well,
because we packed up that bag. There are certain bags we packed up when we were 5 or 6 years old. We have no freaking clue what's in that bag.
Sure. And what if you also included trauma from past lives? If that's a part of the equation.
Sure. Could be. Mm-hmm. Could be, but I think I would always start here first.
Sure.
Only because you're here and the coming together of these two individuals is here. And the reason you're here is because you have the ability and the potential to rectify some pretty major crap if it's possible to find a positive alignment in it.
Yeah.
I think that sometimes there's some near misses. I think that we all agreed, or we all kind of came in with the idea that, yeah, I'm going to be of service. I'm going to be engaged. I'm going to get into these relationships. I'm going to show up. I'm going to do what I can, but I don't know that, we realize all that we bring.
Agreed.
And so it becomes about the relationship and not about, because it's still about our individual evolution, ultimately.
Right.
Right.
So if we back out of our conversation just for a little bit, I'd like to kind of reset the format or frame around this. And if we use perhaps the classic domestic violence model, the four stages in domestic violence, from an arousal phase or an escalation phase of anxiety and stress that gets to a point where there's a triggering event, and then there's an act of violence, or there's an act of poor conduct, poor choices, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And then there's a period of time of cool down. Then there's the honeymoon phase, and then it all starts over again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a class, and whether that's repeated three or four times in a major way in a relationship to where one person chooses to leave, they end up finding a partner to repeat the cycle, and they do it all over again, just with a new partner. So that's one repetition compulsion that happens quite frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happening with people that I'm finding or that I'm working with and have experienced myself in some ways, where there's this, everything's going fine. And then there's underlying either conscious and probably more subconscious or unconscious anxiety over something, that then there's a triggering event.
Mm-hmm.
There's some poor behavior that gets enacted. And then there's a cool down or a separation period that unfolds. And then there's the honeymoon phase of, I'm sorry, honey, and cards and flowers and candies and take place. And then we have the honeymoon and, gosh, I like you so much better this way. And can't we do this all the time? Of course we can. And then it starts all over again.
Yes.
And I think the way
you're describing it, I would contend strongly that the triggering event, the feeling that occurs, is a direct result of the unwillingness of the individual experiencing the trigger, mm-hmm, to look at their shit.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, 100%. To simply stop. I mean, and I can say that from firsthand experience, because, you know, that's been something in this relationship. There's never been a physical issue. But there was in my marriage to my wife. There was an escalation of intensity, and that was largely driven on all of my insecurities, you know, and my inability to trust myself, and my inability to understand, and my inability to stop and look at what I was doing, you know, that led up to that. Because those events, again, they don't occur in a vacuum. In most cases, and again, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, because it's been my experience, the event that triggered the violence was the end result, not the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So that triggering happened somewhere else or in some other experience, mm-hmm, prior to that. But there's something about the dynamic of relationship that gives us permission to take it out on the individual we're with.
Yeah. Don't we have a phrase for that? We always hurt the ones we love.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them. You could meme that to death, you know. But the reality is that what brought it to the table had nothing to do with that other person. It was just a convenient place to unload the energy.
When you
look at it that way, it changes the level of responsibility that we each have to take in those circumstances, and it changes. I think it also changes it's responsibility and integrity, because there's, regardless of where you end up going, the loss of control is an actual is just like fear. It's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Loss of control, there's a moment where you have the ability to stop and you chose not to.
Mm-hmm.
That ability to stop may have happened an hour before your trigger. It may have happened a ways before you actually got into the event. You just gave yourself permission to lose your shit right there.
Right. So the payoff, what the repetition compulsion payoff is at that moment where I'm losing my shit, your brain is producing prolific amounts of analgesics that sedate you. And so the payoff, it's no different than a clinical term called trichotillomania. It's no different than what's popular in younger age range of cutting. It's no different than anorexia bulimia with regard to purging using vomiting. So when it's no different than headbanging. So there's four examples I just used that are more individualized than the dance we do in relationship. But when I beat my head against the wall, metaphorically, my brain is going to create natural opiates to sedate the pain that I'm feeling from doing that. Physically, the physical pain. That's what seems to be what people focus on, is the physical pain is generally what we call pain. What happens, what's really fascinating to me, is that the motor control center of the brain and the emotional control center of the brain, they live right next door to each other. Mm-hmm. So if there's a flood of analgesics that hit the physical pain center of the brain, there's a spillover effect that's also going to sedate the emotional control center of the brain. So they're both getting high. They're both getting sedated. So people that do physical acts, headbanging, vomiting, intentional vomiting, sticking your finger down your throat, or pulling your hair out, they're doing something physical that creates a physical response in the brain to sedate the physical pain, but the payoff is the emotional sedation.
Right. Well, that's where I was going.
Hardly anybody knows that, especially with regard.
It's funny that you said it, because that was the first. Was like, and it must be something that I've come across before, because that was my first response. Was, well, yeah, they're not even paying attention to the physical pain. They don't care about the physical pain. If they did, they wouldn't do it. They're looking for a way to stop feeling the emotional pain.
Right. Right. And that's
so if I bang my head against the wall, it's sort of that you know, that somebody walks up to you and says, "I have a toothache," and you stomp on their foot.
Right.
So do you feel better now?
Yeah. That's why we rub a mosquito bite. It actually transfers the focal area of discomfort and it spreads it around to a larger area. So that was one of the things, and that's what we're doing in a relationship. It's like, hey, I hurt right here, so I'm going to get you involved and spread the love.
Or something.
Help me treat this pain that I'm feeling. So when people have an eating disorder and they think they're so focused on their body image, and that's what most of the eating disorder programs are oriented around, is to help people have a healthier body image, a truer sense of self. What they don't realize is the act of vomiting is a violent, violent act on the body. It takes a lot to make that happen. And as a result, there's a prolific amount of analgesics that are secreted on the pituitary gland that create that overall sense of, oh, I feel better now. And we all think it's because I got whatever the crap out of my stomach was, or I won't gain the weight that if I would have kept the food in me, most of the programs are oriented around that being the issue and having to tell yourself that's not the issue. And again, the real issue is the neurochemical response that's taking place from that act, that physical act. When you get people to realize that there are better ways to calm yourself down emotionally than having to throw up, pull your hair out, beat your head against the wall, or cut. Cutting is the exact same thing. It's creating a physical wound on the body that creates an emotional sedation. And I would say that arguing in a relationship repetitively for what seemed to be nonsensical, or say on a scale of 1 to 10, where say cheating was a 10, or 9 or a 10 or something like that, physical violence would be a 9 or a 10. When couples find themselves arguing over the ones, twos, and threes, but they're having serious fights over it, it's like you said, it's not about the issue itself. That was just a convenient trigger to get the sedation going. That's about something else. And that's the frustrating part, is through the continued use of sedation, however you're getting it, you never get to the core issue.
True. Yeah, because you're just putting a Band-Aid on a bigger and bigger blister.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point it's going to rupture. The question is it going to rupture on your time or on somebody else's time? You know, it's like, where is that going to happen?
But right.
I'm having an interesting experience as you're talking about this, because it's all, I mean, it's all very interesting, but it's all, it's almost like it's the same. I keep hearing the same thing. The behavior is violent and harmful. It's not helping them get to what's the, why are they making that? Why is that decision important? Which comes back to the idea of the habit. But it's still a question of what stops the habit is questioning the habit. Is becoming conscious that I'm doing this on a regular, why am I doing this on a regular basis? You may not get an answer in the first 10 minutes, but if you keep asking the question, there's going to be a point where stuff is going to start to come up. But the problem is that stuff coming up then causes a reaction, which sends him down the path of this loop again. You know, in relationship, that's a big challenge, because we've been trained to believe that the important thing of a relationship is you have to trust each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes the thing, you know, particularly around, not about anything, I mean, but we have to trust each other. And I'm going to tell you, that only comes when you trust yourself, and then you trust yourself. Because
mm-hmm.
if you can't manage to not smack your wife, you have no control, and there's no what I just said. There's no point that you of. I just lost the, what did I just say? What are the words I just used? I can't believe I just forgot them. That's crazy.
I was wondering, do you think there's also cases where the wife is smacking the husband?
Sure, absolutely.
Just wanted to be fair.
Yeah. It wasn't meant to sound one-sided. It was just the first thing that popped into the brain. But this,
so we were talking about the underlying issue and never really getting there, that the repetition compulsion keeps you at the surface level and doesn't allow the exploration into the, what the heck is driving all this to begin with, right? So let's take our conversation there.
Oh, because we were talking about trust. So it becomes, but see, the thing is that I think that screws up with relationships is you play out that game, and the end result, the makeup sex, the end game of, oh, honey, I'm sorry, and here's the flowers and the candy and the yada and the yada and the yada, are still, are resolving a non-existent problem.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning.
Yeah, totally. Keep going, man. You're on.
You got it.
Go.
Right. So it's like, it's a non-existent problem in the sense that the problem is I don't trust myself enough not to hit you. I don't trust myself enough. I don't love myself enough. I don't find myself worthy enough to show you how I really feel about who I am. And when you reflect to me that I'm less than who I think I am, I'm going to smack the snot out of you, because who are you to tell me I'm not who I think I am? I don't think I'm who I think I am. And you can't know that I can't think that. So I'm going to beat you because you're the one that brought it up. And so that trust piece, you know, it still comes back to how do I as an individual, because if I don't trust me, I'm not going to trust you.
Right.
Can't happen. There's no path to get here from there.
Right.
Get there from here. Oh.
So I want to push even deeper here.
Yeah, man.
On the issue of trust and trust of self. If we can make this really simplistic, I don't trust myself to be content. I don't trust myself to create a lifestyle or an environment in which I can live in and operate in and come and go in, where I can be content more than I can be discontent. Wow. And I need you. I'm going to force you to behave in a certain way so that I can be content. Because I don't know how to do that myself.
Yeah, that's
and
a good one.
That's called control. That's called control. And it will only never work.
Only and ever, right.
Only never.
I love those only never ones.
So let's take cheating, for example. If I absolutely need to be in a relationship where there's no cheating, and if you do, it's over, that means I can't be content knowing that I'm lovable, acceptable, valuable, period, without you behaving a certain way. If I can only be acceptable, lovable, valuable based on how you behave, I don't know how to do it for myself. And that's why I need you, and I have these expectations to behave in a certain way so that I can be okay. It's like, I don't know how to be okay unless you're okay. I don't know how to be okay unless you behave and you follow all these rules and laws and expectations that we put in relationship.
Well, and part of that is because the paradigm of relationship is faulty. We've built this romanticized version of what it is to be in relationship, and then started creating through, somehow we always managed to get back here, through religion, has managed to create a complete illusion of what relationship is about. I mean, you know, and we've talked about this before too, but to the degree, even to the degree of the fake nonsense about engagement rings, you know, and diamonds and all that stuff, that's just not, it's not what it's pretended to be. So I think we have to take a look at the truth of what is relationship, with regard to, again, it's a very individual process. You know, there are a ton of people out there having amazing relationships because they don't have any rigid structures around what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And for the people who require the religious structure, it's like, ooh, how do you do that? Well, if the individuals who were stuck in the paradigm stopped for a second and just looked at how much of that they're not comfortable with, they'd stop doing it too. Because going in, I mean, just think about all the cottage industries that have been built on relationships. Just in Match.com and Fish, what's it, Fish? There's one called Fish that's more of a religiously driven match site. You know, I mean, there's a bunch of them, but there's all of these sites that make you come up with criteria and make you come up with lists of who, you know, your yeses and your nos and your wants and your not wants, and defining the concept of a relationship within a structure that doesn't serve to begin with. You know, and you try to say to somebody, well, maybe if you lose your list, you might find what you're looking for, because you're assuming from here that you know, instead of from here.
Right.
Here being heart space. And so when you take it back to core vibration, you can still, I don't care how many lists you make. I don't care how many times you define all the things you want in a relationship. If your core vibration is at level one of relationship, you know, or if your core vibration is established in such a way that your belief systems are structured to create faulty relationships, because you're trying to understand your relationship with self, and that other individual is there to help bring those things to light, you know, to help. And so instead of seeing it as triggering, we should see it as a part of what brings us more fully into our own experience.
Right. So I'm in a relationship in order to better understand myself.
And have some fun and companionship. But ultimately, yeah, I think. I mean, ultimately it would be great if we were in relationships for the fun and the companionship, and that's where it ended, you know, and by virtue of the fact that there is an alignment between these two people, there's going to be things that evolve that you get to grow through and understand more. And, you know, but that's a gentleness and a consciousness that you have to bring to the relationship in order for it to move that direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, even last night, you know, last night I came home and I had a bunch. Well, I mean, you and I talked. I had a bunch of crap on my brain. I was not feeling in a very positive place. I was feeling a little edgy and negative and frustrated. And Michael came home, and I had been having some frustration because he's been working a lot. And over the course of the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 days, it didn't seem like there was a lot of attention being paid to the relationship and to us. And I found myself suddenly transferring all of that into that. And now I wanted to get all twisted about, you know, why aren't you paying attention to me? Mm-hmm. And I started to go there, and I went, what are you doing? Oh, time out. He has done absolutely nothing wrong. He's doing exactly what he needs to be doing.
Right.
Why are you feeling insecure and alone? And why are you feeling all of those feelings? Well, I was already feeling all of those feelings. So I just decided that I was going to lump them all in my little relationship bag, and I was going to see if I could work it out there. And realizing immediately that that was not even remotely good, because, you know, I tried a little foray into the conversation, a very easy, light statement. And his response to my statement was very clear. And I went, wow, okay, that's awfully selfish and inappropriate of you, you know, selfish in a not good way. Because the reality is, it, you know, it is what it is. And I know what it is. It's not even like I'm unclear at all. I know exactly what it is. But the point being that that could have gone in a very, and in my past relationship would have gone to that place.
Mm-hmm.
And would have ruined the night and the next day and the day after that. And, you know, until something else changed. But that habit, it takes a lot of conscious attention to stop and go, wow, I'm really triggered right now. I'm not sure why. You know, some of the self-help stuff that I always found, you know, funny and amusing was that, you know, that you would have those conversations. Well, this is how I'm feeling, and I want to talk about how I'm feeling, and here's what my experience has been, and that's all good. I mean, it's you know, when you're talking from a place of responsibility, but there's also a point where you have to kind of take it in and go, is this really even something that should be brought here?
You right.
know, is this something I need to, you know, because that's a different conversation. There's a conversation that you can say, like I did last night, rather than going in the route of attacking, where's my attention? I realized that it was mine, and I was having a grumpy, I was in a, you know, my headspace wasn't right. So I just simply copped to it, you know, and said, I love you. I'm in a funky place, not about you. I just need to take some space and get myself sorted out. But, you know, I love you. Sleep well. Talk to you tomorrow, you know, and it immediately dissipates the intensity. But it's a tough road, because, again, there's a lot of peeling of layers about what relationships are supposed to be and what they're supposed to act like. And instead of being present in what you have, who is this energy in front of me? And is it an energy I want to be around? Is it an energy that's helping to move the needle forward? Is it an energy that's uplifting and expanding and growing? Or is it an energy that is diminishing and harmful? Because not all, you know, all relationships aren't one or the other, but they are predominant in one fashion or another. And I think that's where you get to decide if that's, is there a possibility of those vibrations coming to the same level, or will they always be like this?
Mm-hmm.
And if they're like this, there is no relationship. It's not a relationship. It's something else. I'm not sure what the word is, but I'll come up with something. But I don't think when you're, you know, in physics, when two things don't have resonance, it's, they don't have a relationship, right? Isn't there a thing for that? Isn't there something called that? I don't know. I have to look it up. But again, when you're here, that's one thing. When you're here, because from this perspective, you're not even seeing the same things. Your perspectives aren't even close. So how can you be relating? What are you relating about? You know? And I went on a long tangent there. So anyway.
Do you remember maybe 20 minutes ago you said something about the triggering event isn't even real, or whatever the discomfort or the discontent is, it's not real. What's happening? The triggering event isn't real, I think is what you said something like. Do you remember that? We were
That was in relation to the I think the thing you were talking about, the brain, the instigation of that, what do you call it again? The fluid.
The compulsion repetition is, that's the term that we're using. But
the thing that stimulates the not the stuff that knocks you out, but the stuff that makes you feel the pain less.
So the analgesic?
Analgesic, that's it. That was the comment was specifically in relation to that, I think. Right. But anyway, so go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the analgesic is real, but the belief that I need it and that we have to fight and do this destructive dance is not real. The underlying issue behind all that is not real. It's a fabrication of truth, which is the antithesis of our podcast. You know, we want to be adventurers in truth and try to dislodge and explore and dispel anti-truth, the opposite of truth.
Yes.
So we spent some time exploring and talking about describing this dance of dysfunction in relationship and also in individual behaviors with regard to bad habits and addictions and whatnot. The premise is that I believe in this moment I'm in a state of discomfort. That's the premise. And we actually choose something that works, because it does, to powerfully get me out of this place, because I don't believe I can handle it. Mm-hmm. I don't believe I can deal with this. I don't know a more constructive way. I don't have the patience to do something like meditation or prayer, any of the other ways, going on a walk, going outside and doing jumping jacks. Mm-hmm. Those all help. Those are all maybe lower level interventions. Putting a few of them together does in fact help. So that's the real issue. The truth is, at some level, I'm believing in this moment, I don't have what I need right now. It's not true. It's never been true. We always have what we need. We couldn't be having this discussion if any part of that wasn't true. We've done a couple of podcasts on this idea that the difference between content and discontent is the confusion between wants and needs. Mm. We're confusing our wants and needs. We have what we need. We've always gotten what we've needed. We always will get what we need. Those are very basic needs. Some oxygen, enough food. Doesn't even have to be every day, but enough food to keep me going. Some water. Treating my wounds if I have any. That's about it. Houses are not needs. Cars are not needs. Relationships aren't even needs. So even, you know, if you think about the dysfunction in a relationship, there's some premise that I need you to love me. I need you to accept me because I don't know how to do it myself. Yeah. I need you to do that for me. That's really what we're saying in this moment. Or, oh my gosh, you believe that about me? Whatever, you know, somebody says something insulting or unkind to you. And our notion is, oh my gosh, they actually think that about me? I can't stand that they think that about me. Well, why not? If it's not true, why are you reacting to it? Hey, I do this too. I'm not above any of this.
Yeah, no.
I play the game.
Well, and again, I think
I get involved.
I was, I'm reminded of the, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You know, it's, I'm inclined here just to throw this in because it's, to me, it's tantamount to progress, you know, or to, mm-hmm. is that we're here to evolve. We're here to grow. We're here to learn in whatever form or fashion that is. And it's not necessarily an easy process. And that's the where the whole leading the horse to water, but you can't make them drink. Well, if somebody doesn't know they're thirsty, why would they drink? Why would they drink? So somehow there has to be an awareness that I'm thirsty.
Sure.
But why hasn't that awareness shown up? Right. Where did they lose the awareness of being thirsty? That's a powerful problem and a big challenge, because yeah, we can talk about solutions all day long, but all of the solutions require engagement. All of the solutions require a level of consciousness. All of the solutions require focus.
Yep.
It doesn't necessarily mean that it requires every ounce of your energy, but sometimes it does.
Sure.
Sometimes the stuff that comes up is pretty extraordinary. But anyway, the point being that you can't do nothing. You can't do anything about an individual who doesn't want to do anything about it.
Right.
And that's where I think the relationships, for relationship purposes, that's where relationships fail, in any form, because there isn't a mutual understanding of the commitment, of the connection, of the evolution that you guys are walking, or whoever's walking together, you know,
right.
Whether it's Michael right. and I or anybody else.
Got a couple of thoughts on my mind. I want to try to get out before they vanish somewhere. One is, you were talking about, you can't lead a horse to water. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. I heard a guy that had like 30 years in AA once say, but you can make them really thirsty if you ride them real hard. And, you know, might increase the likelihood that they'll drink when they get near water. But in our way of discussing all this, what I like to do is kind of use this metaphor. I'm going to kind of demonstrate that in the compulsion repetition, we're walking through life with like a blinder or a visor on that I can't see very far out ahead of me. And what we're really talking about in just being, you said, you know, being conscious of the underlying distortion of truth, or being conscious of the anxiety or the depression, whatever it is all we're really talking about is making a shift like this. It doesn't have to be kind of an awareness thing. It just starts like this.
Yeah.
With something as simple as right now in this 8 seconds, I have what I need. That's a subtle shift. And then maybe backing that up with, in every 8 seconds of my life that I've been alive here on this planet, I've gotten what I've needed. So I've gotten what I've needed. I have what I need now. And those belief systems, which are facts, by the way, not just fairy tales, they're very comforting. If the desire is, I want to self-comfort, I want comfort, because analgesic is going to provide the comfort. But I can provide that myself by just telling myself and reminding myself and reprogramming, because the subconscious, unconscious mind, perhaps as much as 95% of the mind, is saying, you're in a state of discomfort because of this, this, and this. And it's bringing all this stuff up that isn't true, as Jim pointed out a bit ago, is not true. It may have been true, but it isn't true now. Right. I may have gotten beat, abused, whatever, and that all really happened, but it ain't happening right now. But my mind doesn't know the difference between then and now. The subconscious, unconscious mind does not tell time. It's all now, there.
Yep.
And so because the conscious mind does know that was then and this is now, we can say, right now, I have what I need. And stand in that. Take some deep breaths. And begin to reprogram all that junk that's in there, all the lies and distortions of truth that create the repetition compulsion. That's back to this.
Yep.
So all we're doing is going like that and just raising up a little bit. And then you get comfortable living here. And then you want a little bit more. And then you begin to see this come down. And pretty soon you're like, wow, check it out. I kind of like this better. You can always go back to this if it doesn't work.
The incredible amount of freedom that you experience in that transition is crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. And did you hear what I said at the end? It's like, you can always go back to this.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Nobody's going to take it away from you. It's your choice.
Well, that's true. My favorite little one-liner that I use for myself if I find myself in a place that doesn't feel good is everything is always working out for me.
Mm-hmm.
I use it all the time. You know,
sounds
I actually
like Abraham Hicks thing.
I had to use it this morning. Huh?
It sounds like an Abraham Hicks thing.
It is. It is. But it's so profoundly powerful in that just by virtue of allowing that energy into my field changes how I see what's in my field. And sometimes I have to say it 10 times. Sometimes I have to just kind of repeat it for a few minutes and get my juices flowing in that direction instead of in the other direction. And just by virtue of that, I lose some of my defensiveness, or I lose, you know, today I had to deal with a credit card company and a bank and a collection agency, and they were all tied together and it was messed up and it didn't make any sense. and initially I was ready to chew. I got on the phone and the first person I talked to, I found myself chewing. I was like, here's the way it is, and of course they immediately are trying to be defensive and trying to be appeasing, and I could feel that just by my approach I was losing. I could feel it because the person I was talking to wasn't enrolled. The person I was engaging with was anything but enrolled. They were like, can I get the hell off the phone with this nutbag? You know, they don't want to deal with that energy, and they do it all the time. But when I realized I was there and I went, I'm not going to get this resolved in a manner that's going to feel good if I don't shift my vibration. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I started doing. I was like, okay, everything is working out for me. This is awesome. I'm good. You know, and I just kept it in the background. Everything is working out for me. Everything is working out for me. And what it did, maybe it's doing, I would love to have a brain, you know, have somebody look in my brain and see if I'm, you know, my little pineapple is getting juiced up, you know, you know, while I'm doing that, because the change is pretty powerful. so I wasn't finding words. I just had to come up with some words.
It worked.
But the end result was, it's all resolved. I've done everything I can do, and it's what it should have been 6 months ago. But I didn't choose to handle it because I kept waiting and I kept waiting and I kept making, you know, whatever excuse I had going on about my business and blah, blah, blah. And I went, what are you doing? This is just baggage. It's more baggage. You don't need the baggage. You know, when that part of your life came together, it was magic and everything showed up the way it needed to. So if this is a part of the old story, then why would you keep it around?
Yeah. So you the know? Baggage will give you the analgesic, but it'll keep you where you are.
Yeah. Ooh. Say that one again loud.
The baggage will give you the analgesic, but it'll keep you where you are. You stay right there.
Hugely powerful, I think. Hugely powerful.
That's how the baggage serves us.
Yeah. But it's the finding the thing, you know, and again, we're going back to the idea of state shift. There's got to find the thing that takes your attention off of what your attention is on.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care if it's French fries. If you can put your attention on enjoying an order of French fries, you'll stop thinking about what you're thinking about.
Right.
And as soon as you give yourself a break, you create space. When you create space, you can add new energy. When you can add new energy, you can continue to expand that new space and not have this go on, you know, your version, because that's what you're doing. You're taking your old shield and you're going, yeah, I don't want to see this.
Right.
You know, and like right. you said, so now you're back in your baggage and you're right where you left off.
And we've talked about Byron Katie's work. Her blockbuster book, Loving What Is, was followed up by another pretty well successful book called I Need Your Love, Is That True? Question mark.
Mm.
And this was more about relationship, where the first book was more about just individual stuff. But that's another way out of the anagelsic response, or the same old compulsion repetition. Is yes, it's nice to have the other person's love, but we don't need it. It's not a need. It's a want.
No.
And how I get people to accept that, as I said, who were you before you met that person? Did you have any self-love, worth, and acceptance when you were 12, 7, 5? At some point in your life, was your life okay before you met this person? Was it okay enough before you met this person? And yes, now you've gotten to know them and meet them and gotten used to having them around and might even get in a little bit of dependency on them. But the reality is, you by yourself were okay once upon a time before you even ever started dating at all.
Mm-hmm.
You survived. How do I know? Because here you are.
Right. Some form of okay.
Now we have this idea that you complete me. Yeah. Where does that come from? What a bunch of crap is that statement? Seriously, you're laughing because it's true, right? It's true that it's not true.
Now,
right?
Yeah. That's a shutter thing. That's like a boo.
Yeah. But how many people are walking around on the planet? We call it my better half. We have all these terms to describe that.
For my soulmate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And without that person, I'm pointless. I'm aimless. I'm empty. I'm not complete. I'm not making fun of love. I'm really not. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. Like you said, companionship, and you said some other part of it was
fun.
Fun and companionship is a pretty cool thing. And I'm certainly blessed to be able to experience that myself. And
there's intimacy. There's all forms of magic and amazing things that you can explore in the context of relationship, because there's things you can do with somebody that you can't do with that isn't as much fun or isn't as much enjoy or brings more joy because, you know, there's somebody there, you know. I was thinking it's one of the things that I think is so powerful for me in my relationship is I get off on seeing him happy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what it is. I get off on it. It just like it makes everything good. So if there's a way to somehow support that, then I do. You know, last night I was driving. I decided to go out and take a ride to the airport and then got a ride from the airport, and it was getting late and it was dinner time. And, you know, and so I called him like, hey, I'm on my way home. And, you know, he's hungry and he wants to eat and he just got up from a nap. And I thought, I'm just going to go pick up some burritos and take him home and, you know, get him a taco. And, you know, he doesn't know I'm doing it. He'll probably love it. And he did. And it was like, it just made his night because he didn't have to think about it. Didn't have to deal with food. It was like, there it is. There's my food. I had a busy day. I had a lot of work and there's my food and it tastes good. And now I can go to bed, you know, but for me, that moment of that is what it's all about. And if I can't bring that, then I'm not really engaged. There isn't relation going on, you know, but that's part of the fun. That's part of the, cause you get excited about, you know, that, you know,
right.
Because it's that uplifting energy. It's that we're going to new places together energy, as opposed to we're here to beat each other into the ground and show each other how miserable we are, you know. Whoops. So it's so relationships, you know, the it's amazing how much information and books and things are written, and there's so many ways you can approach it, but I think the safest and easiest way is recognizing what you're bringing, you know. And if it falls short, then figure it out. Why am I falling short of my own expectations? They're not having the expectation I am. You know? Well, they may be having their own, but this idea, I'm still kind of running around with this. What's it called? Habit compulsion
repetition.
Compulsion repetition.
Mm-hmm. I'm compelled to repeat my bad behaviors or unproductive behaviors or my anagelsic stimulation system. Yep. That would be a different way of describing it.
Until I make a different choice.
Yeah.
And I think that's another piece of this, you know, Jeff, that I think is so important, is that it starts there. It only requires the decision not to, or the decision to do something else.
Sure.
The first time, you know, we beat ourselves up because we're not perfect all the time. And then we don't act because we're not perfect, which is completely ridiculous, because all it requires is action. You know,
right.
It just says, oh, I don't feel right. Okay. What can I do to change that?
Yeah. So
I'm getting ready to be a complete jerk to somebody. I know, right. I'm going to do it. It's not a surprise to me. So if I already know it's coming, then I have moments in there all throughout the preparation process that I can say, wait, I don't have to go here.
Right.
What other choice could I make right now?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's really, really, really hard, you know, and I know I'll sit there for over an hour because all I can come up with is negative solutions. And I'm like, no, the one I came up with originally isn't going to solve anything. And neither is that. And neither is that. And neither is that. And neither is that. And neither. So, okay, something different. What else? Where else can I go that's different than where I am right now to help me better understand what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And that just requires focus. You know, it requires caring enough about yourself for that minute or 10 or 20 to say, let me go deeper. Let me
right.
pay a little closer attention. Let me dive into this a little more. The more you do it, the more fun it is, because you learn so much about who you are, and you learn so much about stuff. And then sometimes it doesn't feel good because you recognize, you know, your behavior. But see, to me, those things to me are the most powerful is when I recognize that I'm trying to bring something that doesn't serve either of us in our relationship. When I get conscious of that, and then I find a solution that is not the original solution, that is the best feeling ever to me. Because I didn't give in to the negative thing. I took the time to center and say, okay, what can I do differently? How can I approach this? What am I not, whatever questions you can ask. But when the end result comes and I didn't do the negative thing and I found a positive solution, there's nothing like that feeling ever in my
right.
world.
Right.
Nothing like it. It's so empowering. It so validates my worth in such a profound way that you can't miss it. Because you went in and you found it and you brought it out and you went, I did that all by myself. Holy cow, that's amazing. So
I picked up another little nugget of truth as an intervention that I'd like to share.
Cool.
A few moments ago, you were sharing that sometimes we have a negative self-tape of I'm not perfect, or I expected myself to be perfect, or because I'm not perfect, blah, 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 blah. Right? That was, we do that.
Mm-hmm.
What if that's actually not true? The fact or the truth is that I am perfect in where I am right now. I just don't know how to do what I'm learning how to do yet, but that doesn't make me not perfect. That just means I don't know how to do that yet. And I'm learning. And right now in this moment, I am perfect. Before we knew how to ride a bike, we were perfect. We weren't imperfect because we didn't know how to ride a bike. We weren't at a stage of development yet that we had been exposed to. Now it's time for you to learn how to ride a bike. And it didn't go well for most of us straight out and right away. And their skinned knees and skinned hands, right? I mean, that's a perfect process of learning how to ride a bike. That's like the only way it can happen. Skin, knees, and hands.
Isn't it interesting that very few kids carry that trauma?
Right. Yeah.
You could have fallen 400 times and skinned your knees and bumped your head and cried your eyes out, but it doesn't carry. It doesn't stick because there's no, you know, you don't have an you're not coming at that point. You're generally not coming from a place of I'm not good enough. You're just like, this is what I get to do, you know? And so, you know, you cry for a minute, you get up, you get back on the bike, you go on. And then at some point you accomplished, just like I was talking to before, where you solve the problem. You solve it in a way that you never solved before. And suddenly you're on a bike and you're just like, what? You know, and all the rest of it just evaporates. I can't think of anything. I can't think of any point that I ever thought about learning how to ride a bike and the damage I did to myself trying to do that.
Right. And that would never be a nice philosophy to use in all the other things we're learning how to do.
Amen. Sometimes you get bumped. Sometimes you fall down. Sometimes you get a bruise, but just get back up and you try it again.
And somewhere along the way, using bike riding as an example, I didn't wear a helmet when I was a kid, but somewhere along the way between my generation and my kids' generation, somebody said, it's probably a good idea that kids wear a helmet when they're learning how to ride a bike. And it's actually a law in California. Yeah. If under a certain age, your kid needs to have a helmet. It's funny, but you know, there were enough negative experiences. I guess somebody thought it was a better way to do it. And it seems logical that that would be a better way to do that. So maybe part of our podcast would be like, we're putting the helmet on. This might be a better way to do it. And, have less injury, or you know, there's some thing I'm going with here that along the way
there was a bicycle company that figured out that if they made helmets for kids' heads, they could make a lot of money. Like a lot of kids got injured by not wearing helmets, then we could pass laws that would make them wear helmets because they're no more fragile or no more anything else than we were when we were kids.
There's just more kids.
There's just more kids.
More kids,
you know, I don't remember seeing any statistic for the millions of children that were killed learning how to ride a bicycle without a helmet.
Right.
I don't recall hearing those stats anywhere.
Yeah, right, that's
a rather pessimistic view, but I think most of the stuff that we adopt is driven on the profit margin, not on safety or anything else. I mean, it sounds nice and it sounds lovely and it makes it sound like, you know, we care and we're concerned, and all it does is build fear into the kids and build more fear into the kids because now they have to be afraid of everything, because if you fall off your bike and get scraped, oh my God.
Yeah.
Life will end. Like, no, dude, I should push you off your bike so you can get the experience of what it feels like. See?
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
I'm feeling compelled. A compulsion repetition here, perhaps, as we're maybe starting to wrap this up or do a summary. I'm not saying we're done, but I'm getting that sense that I don't have a whole lot more to contribute to this topic. But I would maybe a couple more examples or just some ways to apply it in some other areas that I'm thinking about. Parents that I've provided counseling for that have lost a child and are in that very grief-stricken state, that sometimes, according to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and the book she wrote on death and dying and the stages of grief and loss, sometimes that can take a year and a half, and you really don't want to rush a person through that. But at the end of that time, if people are still stuck in their compulsion to grieve, which is an analgesic of dealing with the reality, that I do take them back and remind them, you were okay before that child came to the planet. And you can be again. You haven't changed. You got used to having them around. And I don't do this in one session, and I don't ram it down their throat. I'm just, for the sake of, if there's anybody in our listening audience that has had that experience, please give me the courtesy right now of going a little more quickly, because I'm not doing counseling and I don't know you personally. But the reality and the truth is that you were okay before that kid was in your life, and you fell in love with them, and they became very special and important to your life. Mm-hmm. And you can be again. You just have to accept that and be joyful for the time that you had with them and the lessons that you learned about parenting with that child and with that spirit and soul. And, you know, quite honestly, would you want them back on the planet again just for your well-being? you know, if you do believe that there's any kind of a life after experience, they've already gotten on with it and they're there and digging it most likely. And it would be an act of selfishness to want them back for our comfort. And it would be, this is the growth opportunity right here, is what I'm about to share, is the act of selfishness is an admission of, I don't know how to be okay without them. And that's not healthy.
Right.
Why? So the health,
because
the
why
healthy,
is my okayness built on them?
Yes.
Exactly.
And whether that's a kid, a parent, a spouse, a brother or sister, it's not healthy at that level. Beautiful. And I think that's what I wanted to share. And
I like that a lot. It's very powerful. And to my world, very true. You know, it just speaks to everything we've been talking about, where you're, you know, it's all outside of you. It's all, you know, it's about them and it's not about me. And about, yeah, very good. Like that. This has been a very powerful conversation. I think has gone in a lot of different directions, and I'm sure there's probably quite a few things that we could even, not in this podcast, but, you know, be able to take to another level. But I think that's been kind of happening for us over the night, over these last few weeks, is that we're building this kind of repertoire, but we're getting, each one seems to tie somehow, you know, they're mm-hmm. connected, and we seem to be following that thread well, which is really cool. And we're very much appreciating all of the great people out there who are taking the time to listen and participate. We are looking to explore other venues to maybe actually be able to engage in our podcast with other people, which I think the Zoom platform gives us that possibility. If we decide to go there, we can actually do live podcast that people can actually interact with. That could be interesting too. Mm-hmm. But we greatly appreciate, we love doing this. We love the time that we get to share, you know, talking about this stuff and learning about this stuff and finding out what all of our, where our truths lie. And it's kind of cool to get to do that.
It's interesting that it came out that way, that you, I know it wasn't L-I-E that you used, but where our truths lie, that's yeah. deep, what you just said right there.
For another day. That's real. Wow. That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
That could be the title of another podcast, you know?
Right? Where does the truth lie? Wow. I like that. Anything you would like to bring to the front in closing as we're wrapping up today?
No, just also a gratitude for people that are tuning in and helping us figure this out. I am getting feedback from people in my practice that I'm turning this on to, or friends and family, and they're giving helpful feedback. Some of it technical, some of it more engaging. So do appreciate all of that.
Good.
And we're growing and learning. And just encourage you to check us out on the Facebook page and also on YouTube. And Jim, yep. if you could remind folks of there are two different ways of finding us. And if you could let people know, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, both are Adventures in Truth podcast. Whether you're going to the Facebook page, we post our new videos there. So you can comment, you can like them, you can share them. But you can also go to our YouTube page and share them from there and like them there. Either way, we appreciate the interaction and would love the feedback and engagement, but let us know if there's anything you want us to dive into that would be fun.
All right, man.
Thank you, Dr. Jeff. Good to see you. Good talking
too,
with
Jim.
You, as always. And I'll talk to you very soon.
All right. So long, everyone.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Adventures in Truth podcast. If you would like to listen to more or to explore all our offerings, visit us on the web at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com. We also offer video versions of our podcast. Visit our page on YouTube at Adventures in Truth Podcast. We would love to hear from you. like, connect, and follow with us on Facebook. Want to book us for your next podcast or to speak at your event? Head over to our webpage at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com at the bottom of the page and send us a note. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to seeing you again at Adventures in Truth Podcast.